Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. Now, today is the Christmas show. I do this once a year, and well, I do it once every year as a recognition that there is absolutely nothing wrong with centering our lives on a daily basis or a time of year regarding Christ and centering our lives on Christ. And so, got to give you a little warning. This show has the undertones, or actually, I kind of identify this concept of a conspiracy. Now, when you realize that the conspiracy was exposed in Britain in the 1790s, I think it was 1796, the conspiracy to destroy the governments and religions of Europe by the globalists. So I want you to understand that what we started seeing is the manifestation. What we're going to account for today becomes the manifestation of this conspiracy of getting us to actually serve mammon, to getting us to become so commercialized that we're driven by corporations to, you know, supposedly to quench our desire of worshiping Christ by buying their products. And that is not that is not a proper way of recognizing the birth of Christ. And so one of the things, let me just start off this way, because I may not have time to say it. I would just ask that everybody consider giving of themselves, your time, your talents, your efforts. I know it's so easy to just spend money. Believe me, I know many people, and I'm one man that's guilty of it, that I'll buy my wife jewelry or something because, you know, it's a very expensive gift, and it's something I really care, and it's very personalized and so forth. But it is not what I would consider a good, righteous gift. And if this is all about Christ and being righteous people as Christians, then there's probably nothing better than serving one another. And I remember when I was going through school, in high school and junior high, we had requirements, public service requirements, and we usually fulfilled those requirements during Christmas or, you know, the holidays, by going into the community centers and serving those who, you know, didn't have anything other than, you know, where the church was taking care of the ill, the infirm, what have you. So, and so there's nothing wrong with taking time and recognizing Christ. You know, this is actually one of the two times as a society that the world has to deal with. In other words, they don't like it, and they don't like the taste of saying those words, Christ. But they have to deal with the acknowledgement of the life of Christ, which is his birth and his atonement, or what, you know, the world or the heathens call his death. And so sometimes in the past, and very rarely lately, I don't mention the words Platonism, but this came out, and I started identifying or giving credit to credit where credit's due to the origin or the originator of this concept of statism, a statist government. And so, or communism, what we'd call communism, because it truly comes from Plato and Plato's Republic. At least he was the very first. I mean, I think the author probably was Satan, but he was the first to actually commit something to paper or whatever they wrote way back before Christ, what, 500-600 years before Christ, whatever that was, in writing and in inscribing the words of Plato the Republic, that put in motion this altruistic idea that the state could love us and take care of us better than we could for ourselves. And so this Christmas show will give you a macro view of how the Platonists or statists first began a mass manipulation program at a world scale. Because if you really look at Christmas today, there's not a corporation in existence in the world that doesn't look at their you know, post-Thanksgiving, Christmas, this winter sales. And so keep in mind that the new Platonist efforts also began in 1776. We talk about this. This was the charter for the Illuminati. Now, this Platonist effort was a direct contrast to the framers and what they were doing here in the Republic in 1776. As a perceived, quote-unquote, good, the Platonists, and they knew it wasn't real, we were going to be convinced that these things were good for us while they gained control over us. And so they create this perceived good of what they believed was necessary for setting the stage for our future manipulation and further subjugating us and ultimately controlling us all. And we're at that point now that we're getting so close to the ultimate control over the world and the people. Anyway, as a replacement, what they did as a replacement for the Golden Rule, they started teaching themselves this new concept because, you know, the Golden Rule, do unto those that you'd have them do unto you, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Their mantra is the ends justify the means. So it doesn't matter whether we hurt you or how we treat you. It justifies the means of what we need to do. This is why an accurate historic perspective is not just important, it's critical. Or at least an accurate one, as one can do with the potential filters that one deals with. I mean, even myself, I have filters that I have to acknowledge, and I try my best to put those aside. So we'll see how good I do. So in this encapsulated view of Christmas, or how we, the historical progress of how this all occurred, is something that this show is all about. It's not about kicking Santa in the teeth. It's about trying to create context to what we should really be doing instead of allowing them to tell us what we should be doing. In the early 17th century, now we're talking 1600s now, right? A wave of religious reform in Britain changed the way the winter wilding was celebrated in Europe. Now, just keep in mind, the early 1600s, this is right after Britain became the empire. They just knocked off the Armada, the Spanish Armada. And that was at the end of the 16th century. So going into the 17th century, the sun started shining on Britain. And so this wave of religious reform, because what else was happening? This is King Henry had, you know, cast off the Catholic Church, tried to create his own. So there was this bubbling pot, a scalding, boiling pot, boiling over in Britain because of this religious persecution, oppression, and so forth, because not everybody was wanting to go along with what was best for the king religiously. And so, as we kind of look, this was an evolution led by influencers and government, ultimately establishing Christmas from this early 17th century to today. You know, all of these different hands in the pot, all these different cooks in the kitchen were involved in getting us to where we are, giving the people the false belief in a true Christmas. But I'm getting ahead of myself. First off, there was also during this, this glorious revolution in America, this was the late 1600s in America. America was already going through its first religious awakening. This first religious awakening in the 1600s was the tolerance of Christian religions. In other words, we shouldn't be fighting each other. We basically believe in the same guy. We're all kind of on the same team. And they were recognizing here in America that we didn't want to start implementing the same kind of crap that they were doing in Europe in warring and fighting each other because they like their Christian faith and doctrine better. And so this really started getting things moving in 1600. And in Europe, Oliver Cromwell and his Puritan forces took over England in 1645. they vowed to get rid of England's decadence. And as a part of that, they canceled the winter holiday, which was at that time kind of referred to Christmas. I don't know if it was really well documented, but there's books that basically say they referenced that, or it was kind of referencing what we call Christmas today. I believe it was just still really the pagan winter holiday. Charles II was restored to the throne shortly thereafter, and with him came the return of the popular winter wilding and decadence. Well, you know, here's the king trying to inflict their religious beliefs on people, and most of England were really good people. They all had, you know, they're stubborn, strong-headed, and they just would die over principles. I mean, that was a part of the, you know, keep the stiff upper lip, you know, just bear it kind of thing. And so England was rife with all sorts of contention. And when King Charles came back, it kind of brought the pot to a boil again, which forced a new revolution. And that revolution was called the Glorious Revolution. And once again, they, you know, had to cast off the tyranny of government and of the, you know, so that the people could be more free. So at that point in time, also, actually, let's go back a little bit. We also know that the Pilgrims were a religious separatist group that actually came from Britain as well. They got here in the 1620s, but it wasn't just one set of ships. It was a long migration of people. Just like many of the other colonies had long migrations of people, it took a while to finally, those who really wanted to flee because it was that bad, they just weren't going to put up with this inflicted new religion. And so many of those who came here, Quakers or what have you, they all had this religious persecution driving them out. And so I spoke about this in the Thanksgiving message broadcast and how the Puritans actually failed in the implementation of socialism in the New England states or up there in Massachusetts. Anyway, the pagan version of the winter wildings or this winter holiday was not really an early American tradition, just more of a bad behavior excuse for doing something, even though there was some records of it occurring. As a matter of fact, from 1659 to 1681, the celebration of pagan wilding or this winter wilding holiday was outlawed in Boston. Anyone exhibiting what they called the Christmas spirit, what they were calling it, which was literally just being drunk or disorderly, was fined 5 shillings. Now, in contrast, down in Jamestown in that same period of time, I think it was Captain John Smith, or maybe even before then, he reported that the pagan celebration was enjoyed by all without incident. In other words, they were already aware of the fact that when they celebrated this because everybody got drunk and disorderly, it always caused problems. And so that it actually had to be reported, or it's more important that we highlight that in the report they said it went without incident, which was a very rare occasion. So going into the American Revolution, this is when the English customs began falling out of favor, including the winter wilding or the pagan winter holiday. In fact, Congress was in session on December 25th, 1789, the first supposedly Christmas under the America's new Constitution. There was no problems noted of any wilding during that year, lewd or carnal behavior during the winter months, or the newly formed Constitution. Now, to be clear here, folks, it seemed like this nation had been humbled itself and it was truly counting its blessings. It just came out of Washington's Thanksgiving proclamation and celebrating and serving the Lord for one day, the fourth Thursday of November. So just a few weeks before. So at this point in time, you know, they were still a reverent and humble people. Keep in mind also that Christmas was never declared, just as a foresight. Christmas wasn't declared a federal holiday until June 26th, 1870, almost a century later. Now, I'm not going to repeat that. I may repeat that if we have time. But the point is that there's this huge span of what happened in America to actually formalize Christmas a century later to a point at the birth of this Constitutional Republic. Christmas was not even a holiday. It wasn't even a blip in America. Because again, it was one of those evils we saw out of Europe, the paganism and so forth. It had no direct, first off, this pagan holiday had no direct association to Christ whatsoever. That said, in the 1800s, in the 19th century, Americans were beginning to get manipulated into romanticizing and embracing the transformation of this pagan holiday into something a little more sacred, Christmas. It was the elitists who were behind this evolution and changed it from a loud and rowdy carnival holiday into a family-centered day of peace and nostalgia. But how did they do this? And so this is kind of what I want to do is I want to show you at a macro view the early 1800s, what was going on. Because what was really happening wasn't this celebration of Christmas. We were just getting out of the American Revolution. That was, what, 1814, right? And so at the end of the 1700s, you got to remember that this class warfare started beginning. Because that was the heart of the French Revolution. And that started going throughout Europe, this class revolution. And so this started beginning to leach into the American environment. As a matter of fact, the idea of organized labor and unions were being introduced into America in the early 1800s from Europe. This concept, this new beautiful concept of centralized, or I should say localized and controlled labor, collective labor force. In other words, everybody gets equally treated. You don't get rewarded for your hard work. Everybody has the same job and you just do what's expected of you and nobody performs better or worse. It is an insidious concept. Collectivism is an insidious concept. So in the early 19th century, early 1800s, unemployment began to get high because at this point we were no longer fighting for our lives and things started kind of moving in the right direction. And gang rioting by disenchanted classes actually started occurring what we call this winter season or this winter wilding. And so At some points in time, it really started getting out of hand. And as a matter of fact, just leaping into 1828, the New York City Council instituted and permeated, or I should say created and galvanized, the New York police force in response to a winter holiday riot that basically started motivating elitists in population centers to begin promoting and manufacturing and getting behind this Christmas concept, the stories that were already being published and so forth. They said, this is our way. This is our way of changing us from this godforsaken winter wilding to this new God manipulation or the government manipulation of some concocted religious thing. This was all a part of the manipulation. Now, whether somebody was sitting there at a drawing map or, you know, with some briefing of a strategy of how they were going to succeed in doing this and undermining, I don't think that occurred. But I think that this manipulation was the spirit, an evil spirit that was basically crawling across the earth, where more and more people started getting behind this concept of controlling the people and basically moving people, you know, into a way where they could be controlled more and more. And we'll actually see how this all starts to unfurl. Because before this game-changing riot, elitists were being harassed and galvanized the elitist intent to begin changing the way this winter wilding was being celebrated in America, or more aptly stated, to change the behavior of the growing interest in the wilding time of year to be something other than wilding. And so in 1819, a gentleman called Washington Irvin wrote the Sketchbook of Jeffrey Cannon, Gentleman. This series of stories about the celebration of quote-unquote Christmas in an English manner began shifting the paradigm of Christmas. Now, the stories were about an English squire who invented the peasants, or actually not invented, I'm sorry, who invited the peasants into his home for the holiday. In contrast to the problems faced in American society, the two groups mingled effortlessly in these stories. And actually, when you're looking at this, these were actually happening in England. But these were these romantic stories that were being read in America, being concocted in America. In Irving's mind, Christmas was a peaceful, warm-hearted holiday bringing groups together across the lines of wealth and social status. Why? Because during the winter is truly the time where the indigent, the less wealthy are really tried because they just don't have the means of being able to store up all the food and all of that, where the wealthy are well taken care of. And this is one of the reasons why the winter wilding was such a contrast to any other time of the year, when the only thing they had, which was a staple called whiskey was considered a staple because it was a grain alcohol. And it may not have been the same proof as it is today, but it was one of those things that they used for nutrients. And it also was a good buzz. And so they started really overindulging in doing this. Back to Irving, though. Irving's fictional celebrations of these disparate classes and how they enjoyed what they imagined were ancient traditions or customs were being basically presented to American people, and it became a very romantic point in American history. And so, to be clear, Irving's books were never based on any holiday celebration that he ever attended, he ever heard of, or anything that he read of. In fact, historians have actually come right out and said Irving's accounts actually invented the tradition by implying that it described the true customs of the season when they were completely contrived. Okay, so just this was the basis. This was the this wanting of people to not have to necessarily struggle and, you know, to have the acceptance and the assistance from those who have, getting them to share a little bit. Because bottom line, if you don't, you're going to be sorry. If you don't basically help, you know, the underclass, if you don't help those who are literally facing life in a life or death instance almost every day, because it's either, you know, fight or be destroyed. When you don't have anything, you can't, don't have anything saved, you can't actually, you know, become self-sufficient. This is why when we talk about an enlightened society is where everybody becomes self-sufficient and self-providing, that you may not one year have the ability to make it through a hard winter. But in the years to come, you will, because of your self-sufficiency, you will store for your needs for what you need to get by in the years to come. You shouldn't, and it should not be an acceptable paradigm to say, I need to ask somebody for help. I mean, it's one thing to be worthy of somebody being willing to help you. That's the key right there. This is one of the things, there are people that constantly have their hand out. You know, God has told us, or Christ has told us, that the poor you'll always have. Well, we can actually do something about that. We can actually, if they're capable of working, then they're capable of actually becoming self-sufficient. So we can do something about that, but we can't do something about the poor that are infirmed, or they're sick, or they're widowed, and or they're just not capable of working. There is a class, a group of people that are just not capable of working and providing for themselves, folks. And so we, as a society, as Christians, as Christ said, we have an obligation to helping those, and we need to willingly and impart with. And actually, I won't get into that. We're going into break, so when we come back, I'll get back into the kind of this historical view of this macro, this map, at a high level view of what the heck's going on in the early 1800s. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so I could easily jump into today and kind of show you how we have this. It's still being practiced by elitists. If you don't think so, just really, before I dive back into the history, look at some of the elitist artists. When we look at the Beatles, were those four, the Fab Four, were they Christian in any way? Well, they may have been, but their music was not representative of that. And yet, when they finally got to a point of prominence, why did they even make Christmas songs when actually it became pretty obvious that their actions and words out of their mouth was they didn't believe in Christ? As a matter of fact, I think it was John Lennon that said, we mean more to the kids today, of kids of America, than Christ does. In other words, they were more important to the kids than Christ. And so, when we look at these elitists, why is it that these elitists actually do this? I mean, Neil Diamond, I believe he's Jewish. He created a Christmas album. And so we can see how, you know, whenever somebody comes out with a Christmas album, you got to really question whether it is truly a form of their expression of religious, you know, background, or whether that is just a part of maintaining the facade. Because many times these record companies, they know they need to keep us because these are the things that keep us enthralled. We got to keep spending money. We got to basically keep this machine moving until it collapses on us. And so let's look at the early 1800s now. In the early 1800s, we actually started seeing this, the end of the war, right? The technical end of the Revolutionary War came by the Treaty of Ghent signed in 1814. So that point in time was basically galvanized as we were now free of Britain. They may have been our enemy still, and they were, but we were free from them no longer harassing us. They knew that they just couldn't come back, you know, with military force to take us over. So they had to go down different means. Okay, what else was going on? Well, the French Revolution, right? And as a matter of fact, the expanse of America happened in early 1803 when Thomas Jefferson bought all that land from whom? France. Now, somebody says, and a lot of people like to point out, but let's just think about this. Every piece of land that we have in America, from sea to shining sea, right, the 48 contiguous states, did we steal those from the native inhabitants? The natives, I guess I'll just keep it that. And so did we actually steal that? No, we actually bought all of that. We bought it either from Britain, we bought it from Russia. We've bought this land that we could actually make a land of liberty out of it. And even though we behaved badly as presidents and so forth in creating treaties that subjugated Indians instead of actually freeing them and allowing them to Now, granted, there were lots of contentions because the two paradigms didn't necessarily mix. And so right, wrong, or indifferent, we were functioning in one paradigm and under the international laws of the laws of nations, where the Indians, or I should say the natives, were, you know, functioning based on their tribes, tribe customs, and so forth. And so it became more of a clash of maybe cultures and religion than anything else. And it was unfortunate that things progressed and perpetuated the way they did instead of embracing and uniting and basically becoming one as a nation like we should have. But putting that aside, the evangelical faith was also in the early 1800s beginning to actually evolve as well. The early 19th century, as I probably alluded to before several times, this was the beginning of the Second Awakening in America. And as a matter of fact, I like to look at the Second Awakening with a different perspective than most anybody else. The Second Awakening shifted away the community's responsibility in, you know, being the compassionate services of the people. We were all a part of this as a community, that everybody contributed in the church one way or the other. And instead, we started getting professional pastors who actually started making a living off of this. Now, they started ruining, and actually they started forcing religion to actually become professional and full-time, where instead of everybody, you know, contributing kind of kumbaya, because that's exactly how Adams described it up in the Puritan faith under his father. His father was the way leader of the religious community, and they all worked for themselves. I mean, when they needed to help somebody, it's kind of like the Quakers. They went out and raised a barn, but they didn't have a lot of poor people in Massachusetts, hardly any at all. And those people were that by choice, and they ended up probably either migrating or getting with the program. It is a sin to leech off of others. And when you actually have that conversation to say that, and then you can actually say that to somebody and not necessarily do it just to hurt their feelings, but to help point out that they have a responsibility, holding people accountable. Imagine that, folks. That's what this whole movement is about, is holding people accountable. So, as we kind of look at these, just a few pieces on the, you know, on the history board, right, in the 1800s, we can kind of see how things were going the way they were. And so the abolition movement was another thing that was actually happening in America. After after the Revolutionary War and the Treaty of Ghent, all of a sudden we started seeing things the way they were. And actually we were seeing this racism, or I should say slavery, was on its way out. And then 1920, the Missouri Compromise, the galvanizing of slavery in America. And oh my gosh, this actually forced the abolition movement to be led by John Quincy Adams, God rest his soul. Because in his entire career, after being removed as president I'm tongue-tied today, so forgive me. After being removed by the election of Andrew Jackson as president, then John Quincy Adams resigned and basically maintained a seat as a senator for Massachusetts in the U.S. Senate until basically his death. And he committed his service to ending slavery. He wasn't black, by the way. I hope you know this, folks. John Quincy Adams wasn't black. He was a white man trying to end slavery in America. So just to be clear here, there is really no skin color that is associated to slavery itself formally. Not that skin color may not have a foundation of slavery, but it does create potentially racism. Now, Thomas Sowell, in his book, Black Rednecks, White Liberals, he identifies how racism was not intended as a part of slavery, but racism became a byproduct because the way it was implemented in America because of the king. Thomas Jefferson pointed this out. Anyway, basically, the party, this new party that replaced the Republican Party, or actually pushed them off quickly, was the Democratic Party. Now, this is interesting because I want you to understand this. In 1922, James Monroe, as a Republican and as the Republican president, was unanimously elected. And 6 years after that, a massive wave and shift moved to the Democratic Party, where they became the dominant party for years. And other parties to oppose them came up, Whigs and so forth, you know, tried to oppose them. But to be clear, this pro-slavery, pro-manipulation, big government Democratic Party took over. And this is where we really started going south, okay? And as such, the North and the South were formally divided, not just on slavery, but even on the issue of Christmas. And we'll get into that, because many Northerners recognized the sins of the celebration of the winter wilding as it was being done at that point. Not everybody was educated. Not everybody was buying Irving's books. Not everybody was into it. So they really had to put this stuff on steroids. And so the Northerners actually just saw the drunkenness and the ill will and even the carnal behavior that was a byproduct of this winter wilding was just unacceptable. To those who sought to be civil, they favored different forms of celebrations throughout the year, such as Thanksgivings, fasting, and serving the Lord and others as a more appropriate way to celebrate the blessings in their lives. In the South, Christmas was an important part of the social season, but not surprisingly, the first three states in America to make Christmas a legal holiday prior to 1870 was the states of Arkansas, I believe it was in Alabama in 1836, Louisiana and Arkansas in 1838. You see my point? I mean, these states were starting to embrace and create this Christmas, and at that point in time, we're going to get into it, but at that point in time, it really wasn't galvanized around Christ. It was just really more of a still a pagan holiday. There was a lot of evolution that had to occur to create this real false world, this perfect world of Christmas that most people have. Again, the intent of the show is not to get you to hate Christmas. It's to shift the paradigm to what we really, why we're really celebrating it, is his birth. Do we have to spend a lot of money that corporations are creating in giving of ourselves to others? I think that we need to start maybe taking a little more time. Instead of taking the money that you have, you know, maybe you should be fasting and giving that to to the community, to the churches and so forth, to say, take care of those without. Maybe investing in a better education system locally. There's all sorts of ways of doing this, folks. But making and helping support the corporate bottom line is not the way to do it. And as long as they see their Black Friday, in other words, as corporations operate, because they're so profit modeled and because they're so, I'll just say, cutthroat, that they actually don't get into the red until November. Well, why don't they actually operate so that every month that they can sustain themselves instead of operating in the red for all year until the end of the year? And actually, most big corporations, the really huge corporations, they're not even struggling anymore. It's the smaller corporations, the mom and pops, that struggle just to compete against these big conglomerates. We need to really review what we're doing. And oh, by the way, with Republic Review and the state sovereignty, global corporations would not be existing in our union. we would not have these manufactured princes and kings and princesses and queens reigning over us that we call corporations. We have allowed them to become the new royal class of the world. And we have all the power to shut that down, at least here in America. So, as we kind of move forward, the point is that in the South, they were quickly embracing this thing called Christmas, right? And so, as we kind of look through the rest of the years on this, as we talk about, as we talk about this slow concept, right? So we already identified the three states, Alabama, Louisiana, and Arkansas, as the states that actually embrace Christmas. This concept actually kept on moving. And so in the concept of Christmas and in the Civil War concept, this tradition really started spreading. Now, there are those who hear the stories of, and actually I was reminded of this story just the other day of a good friend that talked about, you know, where is the spirit of Christmas? You know, when we knew that those people on the battlefield in World War II, when they started hearing the church bells and the people singing, the fighters in the trenches of both sides came out into the middle and they sang together and they put aside the war for that evening and celebrated Christmas. Christians, both sides being Christians. I want you to understand the magnitude of this, but I also want you to understand that these are the minions. These are the people that are doing the deeds for those who are driving the agenda. Here's the question. How many world leaders did Churchill, Roosevelt, Hitler, and Stalin, did they get together and put aside their differences? No. Because they weren't God-fearing and they weren't doing, you know, his will. They were doing someone else's will. And those people who are actually not doing their own will, and as a matter of fact, I like to put it, when you go to the leadership, the leaders are driving agendas. They're put into place of leadership to drive an agenda. Obama drove an agenda. That wasn't Obama's plan. He took credit for the damage he did. George Bush took credit for the damage he did. But when we really look at the people that are actually at the end of the cycle, you know, we're doing the work, pulling the trigger, they don't understand. All they know is what's right and wrong. They're just doing what they're told to do. But when it came time to be able to put their guns down and walk in and actually share, you know, the spirit of Christmas, that right there is a big differentiator, folks. So when we start looking at the Civil War and how Christmas started actually spreading across the country, because we were so engrossed in hating each other between the North and the South that this desire of this greater love would actually start coming forward. Children's books began to play a huge role in spreading the customs of celebrating Christmas, especially the tradition of trimmed trees and gifts gifts delivered by Santa Claus. In other words, these kids were going to get these gifts that were completely manufactured in some, you know, basically this illusionary place. And how were they to get these gifts? Well, that put it on the parents. Well, you do what you can and you give your kids gifts. Give your kids gifts. And that is where it really started. And this manipulation in books increased the desire to extend this to a formal education system with the best intentions, of course, right? I mean, when it comes to the progressives, they always have the best of intentions. Sunday school classes encouraged the celebration of this new quasi-Christian version of paganism. Women's magazines and periodicals were very important in actually promoting and suggesting ways to decorate the holidays as well as how to make these decorations. Folks, go look at the historical documents back in the 1800s of these periodicals that were being published. how to string popcorn to basically create a chain to wrap around your tree that you go out and cut. Many of these things people started doing on their own because they didn't, unless you lived in the city, you had to buy a tree. Well, you actually just did it yourself because that's how Christmas was done, by yourself. Most people were actually making their kids their own little toy guns out of wood or what have you. Children's books, again, play this pivotal role in spreading these customs of celebrating Christmas, especially the tradition of trimming the trees and gifts and so forth by Santa. And they started actually moving these more and more into the catalogs. Remember Sears and Roebuck and those types of things. It wasn't just periodicals. It was now we're selling Christmas gifts. At this time, literature and progressive press had begun to congeal in manipulating social affairs. This was in the mid to late 1800s when they really started coming together and basically promoting this world acceptance of spending your money to getting gifts. By this, and the more you could give, the more righteous you were. Right? I mean, I remember when I was a young man and not having a lot of money, I looked at people that could give because they had lots of money as really righteous people because they were imparting of themselves. And maybe they were, but really what they were doing was they were not really giving money to giving this to the people. Because if you really want to give a gift to the people, give the man or teach the man how to fish. Give them the education, give them the know-how, the skill, so that they can feed themselves for life. That's the true gift. When you look at just giving somebody, a bunch of bread and or crackers and cheese, that is only feeding them for the day or for the, as a snack. So by this time, in the mid to late 1800s, by this time, the avalanche of manipulation, including governments and corporations, were so enthralled by the opportunity this Christmas would then present to them and their bottom line. This was huge. Who wasn't going to get involved in Christmas? The whole world seemed to become a Christian world because of Christmas. But don't be deceived. That was only a facade, because the reality is that slowly and methodically they started churning. Once they got out of hiding, once we really started seeing this coming out of the world agenda, it was well after the UN, and it was probably right around the time of the New World Order, where you actually started seeing corporations saying, actually, happy holidays, not Merry Christmas. They started migrating because they didn't want to have to taste those words anymore. They had to say it for so long. Now, the employees, they really didn't mind, but they were being given policies that they had to change. So don't tell me that this wasn't a long process in waiting so that they could get you to keep on buying so that they could promote and build their strength. It's like the way we have been subsidizing communism throughout the world by spending American dollars. Every good American, by spending money into the corporations blindlessly, just so we can have more, and give. And what we've done is we've helped subsidize them and their control over us. And they're leading us into a cashless society, folks. We got to see all these things. And I hate to say it, Christmas is a part of this. The way we have been celebrating it has been a part of this. We need to start breaking this bad paradigm. We've got to break through and actually start giving of ourselves and helping others. Educate. Take time and educate people. What more can I do? What more can I do for America than educate you and become more literate on the Constitution so that you can recognize what is truly in our grasp and what a foundation we're standing on that the good Lord had blessed us with. Anyway, President Ulysses S. Grant declared Christmas a legal holiday in 1870, as I told you before. The bill to make Christmas a holiday was introduced into the House of Representatives by Representative Burton Chauncey Cook of Illinois. It was approved and passed on the Senate. Why am I giving you these details? Because I want you to hear the language, because we're going to actually dive into this, of what this bill stated. And so here's the wording, or the wording of the Act of Christmas for government. In other words, it was sterile and non-religious and secular even then. Listen to what he says. An act making the first day of January, the 25th day of December, and the 4th day of July, and Thanksgiving Day holidays within the District of Columbia, being enacted by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that the following days, to wit, the first day of January, commonly called New Year's Day, the 4th day of July, the 25th day of December, commonly called Christmas Day, and any day appointed or recommended by the President of the United States as a day of public fast or Thanksgiving, shall be holidays. So in other words, Thanksgiving wasn't even really a holiday. Not ingrained. They obviously celebrated the 4th of July. Yay. The New Year, huh? And Christmas, really? But anyway, these were holidays, and they were called and considered holidays in the District of Columbia. So, and continuing the language, and shall for all purposes of presenting for payment or acceptance of the maturity and protest and giving notice of the dishonor of bills of exchange, bank checks, and our promissory notes or other negotiable or commercial paper be treated and considered as is the first day of the week, commonly called Sunday, and all notes, drafts, checks, or other commercial or negotiable paper failing due or maturing on either of the said holiday shall be deemed as having matured the day previous. By the last quarter of the 19th century, America eagerly decorated trees, caroled, baked, and shopped for the Christmas season. Now, let me stop and recap on that bill. If you want to go look at that bill, it does not say in recognition of the birth of Christ. They're only acknowledging how they are going to set aside that day as a federal holiday and what that means. In other words, there was no platitudes. There was nothing really Christian about it. It was, we are now creating paid labor days, a holiday, for the people that work for the government in the District of Columbia. That's what it was. So back to these carols and baked and shopped goods and Christmas season. Since that time, materialism, media, advertising, and mass marketing has made Christmas what it is today. The concept of providing physical gifts to others, like the three wise men who were recognizing the newborn king, is a perversion. The traditions that we enjoy at Christmas today were invented. Some things came to be by blending together customs from many different countries, as most people know this, into what is considered to be our national holiday. Ergo, the roots in the pagan acts give credence to help obfuscate the truth that Christmas was not a holiday in Christ's time or by Christ himself, Passover. That said, many Christians today may not know the details of Christmas, but also most do not know that it is a pagan holiday, unfortunately, that was infused with the celebration of the birth of Christ and made sure that we wouldn't know this. Actually, if people would ask, well, when was Christ born? I'm here to tell you, folks, it's not in the winter. As Christians can choose when and how to celebrate the birth of our Savior, we should remember to have adopted the spirit of celebrating somebody's birth and not necessarily giving to everybody other than of ourselves in service, as he would have given to us. His whole life was a service to us. Why aren't we imbuing that in recognizing his birth? That's the best way to go forward, folks. Merry Christmas. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.